Jerry Farmer Reel 3. So we're at Pusan, you were telling me.
He was at Pusan, and he was all apprehensive on the ship, just staring at this mountain. And I just thought, you know, what have we got coming? I know everybody was thinking like that, because it was like a somber, dark, creepy place, you know?
And was there any reception for you all?
There was. There was American, all Negro American band on the quayside playing St. Louis Blues March. I was the third one off, and they said, I can hear him said to the three of us, the first three, he said to us, "Welcome the Black Watch to Korea." And we said, "We're Fusiliers," and they called it the Black Watch. Anyway, then we all got in these American trucks, and off we went to some place in Pusan. Went to a camp, Seahawk Camp in Pusan, which was a holding base ready for transit up to the line. Yeah, they kept us there, what they called acclimatisation. They used to wake you up all hours of the night and say we're under attack, mix in the area. And they said it was to get you used to being in a deep sleep, and then you know what it's like, everyone was banging about. We were all taking it as a joke, we were laughing and trying to get your equipment on and all tired, you know. So it was a shambles, but it was a laugh. We never really see the sense in it. But if you go back to sleep and you'd be in a deep sleep about an hour and a half, they'd have all up again. We're under attack and people are laughing and people are swearing and oaching, you know. And someone's trod on my foot and where's my boots? And so that went on for about 3 weeks, I suppose. Yeah, that's it. And then it was up to join the battalion, which was by that time in the front line in a hill called, I think our first position. I've got a map downstairs of the actual positions of the Fusiliers. It came from the War Museum, actually, I think. And it shows all the positions that the Fusiliers occupied. I think it was 159, I think it was called, the first hill that we was on.
And what did it look like?
Korea?
No, this part of the front line that you went to?
Surprisingly not like the front line. Of all the training we did, it seemed not as frightening. When we was there, I couldn't believe it. I thought, well, this is it. It's not going to be that bad at all. Because it was peaceful. There was birds singing and pheasants walking about. And, you know, it was nothing like you would have expected.
What month is this?
Well, I was at 19 on the very day I got to Hong Kong, and it was another 4 days to Pusan. So it was in September, middle of September. And it was lovely, it was autumn colours, and it was really lovely, you know. I described it in the thing I wrote as frighteningly beautiful. That's what Korea was like. It was so beautiful it frightened you, because Korea is called Land of the Morning Calm. And Land of the Morning Calm was a white mist used to hang low with the eels sticking out. Korea is a series of bumps. Everywhere you're looking, Korea, is bumps, you know? And the mist used to hang below these bumps, and it was unbelievable. I mean, most of us boys only ever see... the joke used to be is that the only Chinese we ever see was on the tin of Mandarin oranges. And in the old days, I mean, who ever see Chinese people? I never did. I missed the journey up. That was really frightening, the journey up.
Why?
Well, it took, in those days, I think they say it takes 1.5 hours there, but I can remember it being about an 11-hour train journey, and it was a really old cattle truck type of train. They had kind of slat windows, like you see in the India Raj days, you know, wooden seats, terrible. And we got on this thing in the evening sometime, and they said to me, "Oh, you've got to do a guard at the door, because they get sniped when they get into up north a bit." They had a box of ammunition. They just said, "You sit at this open door," and they've had several people killed by snipers who does the guards, you know. So I thought, oh, you know, that's terrible. It's like the V2 weapons, because you're just waiting for it, you know. It makes you so apprehensive, really. Anyway, it went by peacefully, but the moon used to be shining over the hills, and the train was rattling along, and I'd seen films in those days, you know, the old Raj days where they blow trains up, and that's when it really hit me. It was going to be not very nice. We pulled up at a station halfway up. I think it may have been called Tok Chong. And it's the first time I knew I was in a foreign country. It was an evil place. it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, pitch black dark, and in those days Korea wasn't as modern as it is now. It was like their lamps was tallow lamps, and tallow was animal fat, and the smell of that made it turn to your stomach, made you really feel ill, you know. And this station, they said, get off and stretch your legs if you want to. Well, I got off of this station in the middle of the mound hills and pitch black dark, and there was, everyone seemed to be in uniform, like porters and caps, little thin Chinese, they weren't Chinese, they were funny looking sinister people, tallow lamps burning, shadows, smell. Oh, I thought, oh, I saw the place, you know? And that was my first impression of Korea, was the journey up. But it got nice once we got up there and got off, you know, the scenery got nice, the weather got nice. We were.
And when you got into the front line, were you allocated to some unit?
Yeah, I was put into A Company. I was still at A Company, but there was a stroke of luck there, because as a rifleman, I was allocated into A Company, did a short time of A Company, not really long, and then of all things that happened that you would not believe nowadays was that they wanted six drivers. I wanted six drivers, and they said, can anybody drive? Now, would you believe that most of them young boys in that regiment could not drive? Nobody had cars in those days, you know. My father was a painter and decorator, and he started his own small business up, just small, and he'd always had a van, and he'd shown me how to drive, but I'd never passed the test, but he'd shown me how to do it. So I said, yeah, I can drive. And they said, right, get over there. There's a 5,800 weight lorry, primed mortar bombs. I want them up the mortar section. Yeah? Well, I couldn't even change gear. You had to double the clutch. So I remember this corporal, very helpful. He showed me. He said, oh, don't tell him, you know, you can't do it because they'll send you back. So I said, well, I can drive. I said, but, you know, it was a 1508 Morris. I don't think they're called, not bullnose, but they were cut away sides. So a bit old fashioned now to look at. And I remember taking these mortar bombs, and the case dropped off the back while I was up this hill somewhere, and I heard this crash, and I looked back, and a case had rolled off and gone onto the roadway. It's only a track. And I struggled to put them back on, because I hardly lift them. And I put them back on the lorry, and when I got to the line, they all run. The corporal, I said, the corporal, one dropped off. He went, dropped off. And they were all ready to make a run for it, you know? So I realised then, I can't really say I was frightened, but I realised that was a pretty dangerous stunt to do, you know. And they said they were prime ready for firing, which surprised me, you know. So that was my first inaction type of thing. But now I was HQ Company. Instead of being A Company, I was now HQ Company as a driver, which, according to everybody else, was cushy. But it wasn't. It was worse sometimes. And I was driving along one day, and it hit me that I'd volunteered. That worried me. My whole service, I kept thinking my dad saying, don't volunteer, and I volunteered. And I kept saying to myself, yeah, but driving, I'd rather be a driver any day than an infantryman. But don't never volunteer, he says, you know. Anyway, I did that job driving for a while. And we'll carry on.
Please.
Then an officer approached me and said, the MT officer was a Captain Barter, and he said, I don't know if they watch you and know what you're like, but he said, would you consider, he called me up on company orders, I thought I'd done something wrong, and he said, would you consider driving the signals jeep? It was called the SDS, and I think it stands for SDS, Special Dispatch Service, I think. It was written on the front of your jeep. We had SDS. And somebody said it was called Special or Signal Dispatch Service, because there was no handheld stuff in those days, you know. We had the 88 set, which was a big cumbersome thing. So when there was messages to be taken to any company, this SDS, like the signal runner in the First World War, but they used the jeep. So I thought that's a nice little job, really, to do that. Anyway, a captain, Morris French, Captain French, he was the nephew of the first BC of the Fusiliers on the bridge in the First World War. Captain Deese. We've got a Captain Deese Fusiliers that was killed on a bridge with a Private Godley on a machine gun holding the advance of the Germans. That was his uncle, right? Maurice French, Captain French. So I was now a sequence driver, SDS driver. And I used to have to send messages around the line, and quite a good little job, you know. They'd call me up in the middle of the night and say, yeah, I'll quick take this down. But there was some danger involved in it. Most of my friends didn't think it was dangerous, but I could begin to see the danger one night, which I think made me go prematurely grey, really. I believe that it just started going grey. Shall I be that story?
It is.
He woke me up about 1:30 in the middle of the night, one of the runners, and said to me, get down to Captain French, and Sergeant Hill, the signal sergeant. They wanted a message taken to one of the D company, I think it was, that was right out forward somewhere. It was pitch black dark, bit of a moon out, you know. So they said, you go on your own, that's all we've got to do, it's easy. So I said, well, how will I know? So it's easy. They said, on 159, there was a tunnel that we were all based on the back of the hill. The road that led down to the valley, they made what we called the camouflage tunnel, and it was one-way traffic. And what you had to do is the provost sergeant and his men at the top there, his henchmen we used to call them, they used to wait until something phoned up and said, I'm on the way up, then they'd get you through. So it's a one-way traffic, and it was about 1/4 mile down, zigzagging down, and it was all camouflage netting, which made it was like a tunnel. Yeah? Once you was in it, it was just like being under a load of camouflage netting. Anyway, he let me through there about 1:45. I had this signal that I'm supposed to take somewhere. And he said, the Sergeant Hill said, when you get to the bottom of the tunnel, there's a road goes to the left and there's a road goes to the right, but it'll be taped, white tape. Can't have lights on, never had lights on. So I went down the road and he said, the unbroken tape is to the left, you take the broken tape to the right, and they break it. Follow that. Well, I took the one to the right, and I found that after a while, there was no tape on the road, so I just kept going. And I thought to myself, well, I couldn't run a tape all the way to the front line. Anyway, I seemed to be going for about 20 minutes, and I couldn't see a thing, so I put the windscreen down on the Jeep so that I was in the open. I didn't have to deal with that. Now, you can lower the windscreen on the Jeep so that you don't have to look through the moonlight and darkness. I couldn't see, I kept going out the side, and I was going higher and higher. And I had a blank wall of a mountain on one side, and I had a ravine on the other side, and it was getting narrower and narrower. I thought, this can't be right, you know, it just can't be right. Anyway, I kept thinking to myself, I'll turn back any minute. Any minute I'll turn back, like you do. And I thought, there's no way I can go back so I couldn't find it. How can you do that? I'm mad. So I kept going. I'd give it another 5 minutes, another 5 minutes went by, then the track seemed to come to an end. And then it had widened a bit, and I thought, this seems impossible. Why should I? And suddenly it went downwards. And I thought, oh, this is it, it's going down, that's what I want, downwards. Can't be up on the hill, I want to be in the valley. Well, it was going down and down, and I got to this sort of, this wall, this ravine, and suddenly I see this red glow in the sky. Red glow. And I thought, well, you can't have a red glow in the front line, so I can't be anywhere near where I'm supposed to be going. It was a kind of look like a fire. And I got out of the Jeep. Now I'm in the middle of Korea somewhere, on my own. I thought, oh, God. I crept up to this edge and I looked over and I could see lots of people in this valley, lots of figures. I wouldn't say they were soldiers, but there were lots of figures. And they were all sitting by little brushwood fires, lots of fires. They was all on their haunches, so I knew they were Koreans, they were sitting there. And if I had to say, they seemed to be in white material, white kind of blanketed material. So I thought, they're North Koreans, you know. I really panicked then. So anyway, I tried to turn the Jeep round to go back, and I couldn't do it. I'd done about a 20-point turn, about half hour, because the Jeep on one was overhanging the edge and up against the wall, and I was doing an inch at a time. And it was frightening, you know, my heart was thumping, I was sweating hands, you know, fear gripped me. And by the time I turned around, being a left-hand driver, I was then by the wall of a mountain. Call it a mountain, but a big blank wall hit, you know, rocks. The ravine was down there, hundreds of feet, it seemed to me. And that's where all the people were staying in this valley. And I had to keep as close to the wall as I could, but I couldn't see the edge, you know. I thought, I'm going over any minute, because all the Americans always used to go over. American trucks always down where someone couldn't make it. They used to put up signs, this guy couldn't make it, can you, to slow you down, you know. So, and I got back, you know, and I got back to this, where the tape was. I thought, well, I don't know what to do, pondering, I wish someone was here to help me to, you know, ask. I was the type of person that couldn't make decisions, not office of material. I had to ask what wants to be done, and if you said do it, I would do it. Helen and I walked. If you said do it, I would do it. But I don't want to decide to do it. I can't do that. So there was no one to ask, so I thought, oh, I'll go back. Anyway, I got to the telephone, and the North Koreans used to come around the telephone area and shoot you up. That's what the rumour was. So don't hang about there. So there's a little field telephone in the undergrowth. So wiggled it like this. And Sergeant Grantham, his voice was lovely to hear his voice. He went, gruff. I said, son, it's Signal Street. He said, don't come up. He said, I've got a lorry coming down. Oh, God, my heart was in my mouth. He said, just wait and come up as soon as he clears, right? Well, it seemed like an eternity. So I did what an ostrich does. I laid under the jeep. So I thought, if there's anyone about now. So I must have had my feet sticking out because it's very hard to lay under the jeep. But my head was under. And I laid there and I heard this old drone of this engine coming loud and loud. And when it got down, someone went to get out. It was pitch black dark. And he came, even though I was, and I said, I'll do it for you, mate. He went, oh, thanks. And off he went. He went round to the left. And I phoned up and I said, Sergeant, I said, the lorry's down. He went, oh, okay, come up. Sergeant Grantham. Anyway, I went up. I went back. I went to the bunker. No one was about. I left the signal, which was in the brown envelope, on the table. And I went back to bed. And from that day to this, nobody moaned. Nobody said it was important. I said to Sergeant Hill and I didn't Captain French could say, our officers tend to be, I know it may not have been like that, but where I come from, I was in awe of officers because they was all city gents and businesses, and you couldn't really talk to them on the same level, especially with my Cockney accent. So I never asked the officer, but I asked Sergeant Hill and he said, nah, fires, what do you mean fires? And I asked around, and I still ask now, have any of my friends about the fires? And they said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I never dreamed it. It wasn't a dream. I see it. And I see, there must have been, I said there was thousands, but there wasn't. There was a couple of hundred people around fires, and they were definitely North Korean soldiers, definitely. And that's how far into that territory I'd gone, you know. And when I told Sergeant Hill the next day, and he really listened, he said, be lucky he wasn't captured. He said, if you'd have kept going, he said, show me where on the map. And I said, well, I went that way. And I went, oh, no. He said, what it was, they were on three sides of us, the Chinese. So I had the Chinese actually behind me at one time. Not behind me, but at the side of me at one time. So he said, oh, I don't know, you got back. I said, no, I don't know. But that was one of my most frightening experiences. Really, really worse. I had one other one, but really worse because I got wounded out there. And getting wounded wasn't bad, because when you was hit, you know, you were in a haze and don't care if you die or not, really. I got pretty badly wounded out there. But that was, I was keyed up, you know, and I've never had I'm not an adrenaline type. I never played contact sports, never played football. Not bad at cricket, but I wasn't a toucher, I wasn't a hitter. And that really played on my mind. That it was all the, it was the first time I knew what like stress could be like. I felt stressful, you know, I felt shattered. When I went back to bed, I felt weak and weary, you know? And I think that is when adrenaline flows, isn't it? And that's the after effect, you know? And that was a frightening evening for nothing. And I said, what did they do signaling? He said, oh, don't ask me. That's all Simon said to me. Don't ask me what it was all about. I said, I brought it back. He said, yeah, I don't know. They just was not interested, you know? And that was my first taste of not action, because I must really admit, lots of my friends probably wouldn't like to hear me say it, but the Fusiliers never really figured in a lot of military action in Korea. You probably would know by the history, is that Gloucesters, Black Watch, Duke of Wellingtons, they all really did a lot of action. The Fusiliers didn't do a lot of action. And when I tell my friends, they go away, you know, because their perception of it is patrolling of a night, but I'm talking about real fighting. We never did real fighting, you know. We did, most of our stuff was like nervous fighting out on patrol at night. The moon would come out behind the cloud. I mean, the first time I had an attack of tachycardia, I mean, you know what that tachycardia is when your heart goes out of rhythm. I was calling my wife, and we took a flask and we went calling over Epping Forest, and I had a little Ford Anglia I'd bought with the headlights on the wings, you know, old fashioned stuff, 1939 car. And we was caught in 1954. And we parked up in Epping Forest somewhere, and we sat on the back seat and the kitchen table and the flask at tea, you know, all the innocent stuff. And the moon came out behind the trees and my heart went out of rhythm. And it really frightened me, you know. It all sort of jumped about. But I never knew it was that then. But over the years, I know what it was now. A moonlight against fir trees or scrub. Korea wasn't real trees or real grass, it's scrubland. And when the moon comes out of a cloud, it displays it through all different types of leaves, you know. And that really brings fear into me, even now, you know.
What other experiences did you have?
Well, you could say, I'll tell you the worst one, I think, that is the worst, that I've never, ever, ever been in a lift, used a lift. And I did, in my post office days when I was at Mount Pleasant, I used to carry a parcel. I was only parcel, never did letters. I started in the parcels at Mount Pleasant. And in those days, Moorgate had just been built, Gillett House and all that in Moorgate. And they were all 21 stories, each side of the road. And that was my delivery area with parcels. I used to take a sack of parcels in through the front door, and the commissioner would press the lift button. I said, no, I don't want the lift. So he said, I said, no, I've got a way of working. He said, well, what do you mean? You go to the top floor. No, I start on the first floor and work upwards. Well, he said, I can't believe that. So I said, no, I do. He said, that's silly. I said, no, it's not, because every time I get rid of a parcel, I get lighter. But I did not tell him I can't get in the lift, because young men, you're a bit macho, aren't you, really? And nobody ever knew I couldn't use a lift. All my friends never knew.
But how does this connect with Korea?
Well, how it connected with Korea was the fact that there's a few things happening between frightening experiences, you know, driving around, being shelled, we had lots of mortar bombs in Korea, more than shells, you know, and they were frightening. They used to explode as he was driving along, you know, and just kept going. And as long as you're driving, I never felt afraid, but if you stopped, I was still afraid, you know. This particular night, they said to me, another thing, in the middle of the night, be at the orderly room at the bunker, the signals bunker at midnight. We've got a job for you. Bring the SDS Jeep. Anyway, I got there, and there was four Sergeant Hill, and Captain French, and four other chaps standing there, signals they were. I said, what your job is, you're going to put a broomstick with a roll of wire on the back of your Jeep, right? And then you're going to play the wire out along this mountain road, because they're going, the signalers are now going to lay telephone secretly in the valley so the patrols can use it. Nowadays, I mean, it's so silly, isn't it, when you talk about it. But if you'd have had mobile phones and things, it wouldn't have been necessary. But they wanted somewhere they could make for to phone back if they was in trouble. Right? That's how old-fashioned it was. So I put the broomstick thing with this very big roller wire, and I had the corporal sitting beside me and three chaps in the back, signalers. Now, instructions was, when you get this part of the line, you must not smoke, because you're so near the enemy. They'll see you if you smoke, right? Keep all the lights off the Jeep, talking to a minimum, and when you finish, get back as quick as you can. So it's pretty dangerous. We never told us that, but we assume that. Right, we go out. Everything goes off all right. We lay the wire. They smoking, by the way. I looked down the valley where there was, and there's all these dots whizzing about, and I thought, oh no, they're smoking, you know. And I came back, all settled back in the Jeep. I was tired, and I'm going along, and I went off the road, and the Jeep back axle landed on a stump, a tree stump, and they were all moaning about what rotten driver I was. So we bumped the Jeep up, four wheel drive, got it back on the road, and I thought, well, I'll have to stay more alert here, you know. And we're going along, and suddenly there was this mighty bang, a mortar, come over, and I just lost control of the Jeep. The wheel just flew out of my hand, and I panicked and pressed the accelerator as hard as it was. What I actually did, I pressed the clutch in and pressed the accelerator at the same time. So the engine roared away, and we flew off the road. We just flew off the road, and it flew through the air and turned over, the Jeep, and it rolled down this mountainside, over and over, balancing, and ended up in a river. I think it's called the Samachon, not the Indian, I think it was the Samachon. And it sank to the bottom of 18 feet, I would say it was 18 feet, 18 or 28, but I think 18. But where we went in, it was shallow, like this, so we rolled in, rather than hit. And we landed on the bottom upside down. Now there were three boys in the back, Corporal beside me, me upside down with petrol up my nose because the petrol in the Jeep is under the driver's seat, the tank, the petrol tank, and all it has is a kind of a cushion that flaps open when you want to put your petrol in. And that, I can remember that going up my nose and I couldn't breathe, pitch black darkness in water, and struggling and kicking. We had the canvas sides on in the Jeep at the time, which saved our lives, I would say, because the water just poured in. Have you seen the canvas sides on a Jeep? They have a flap where you can put your arm out.
Yes.
And they only hook on. Water poured in and filled up within seconds. It was full. Well, all I can remember of the incident was punching, kicking, and suddenly it was all bobbing up the top. It was all at the top of the surface. And we somehow dog paddled, because we never had every equipment on, but a couple of us had our rifles. I think I had a Patchett. You know a Patchett? You know the Korean Y Patchett's driver. It's not a Sten gun. It's an Australian Sten gun. A Patchett, really nice weapon. Wooden handle, you know? It looked like a Sten, but a Patchett, they called it. A Patchett. And that was my weapon. Anyway, I kept that with me all the time, held onto that, gripping tight. And we somehow got to the, bobbed up, and we got to the side, scrambled, branded wet, freezing cold. This would have been about March of 53. Freezing cold, shivering and shaking, and me laughing hysterically. I think it was hysterics because I couldn't stop laughing because there was all branded rats, and they was all saying that was a terrible driver, and I just kept laughing. And this corporal just got hold of me, and then I stopped laughing then, so it must have been hysterics. And then we all wondered, I said, what happened? What was the bang? It turned out probably a mortar or a shell. Probably we were seen, you know? I think it was three bangs, actually, but the first one I lost control. After that, we didn't know what to do. We were all stranded there. The Jeep was underwater. And suddenly, we heard this engine coming along. And it turned out to be what they called, the Americans had a truck called a three-quarter. And have you heard of that? Three-quarter. It wasn't as big as our QLs. You know the QLs, the big lorries. Then we had little Morris, 1500 weights. Then we had like Austin Tillies. And we had Jeeps. Well, the three-quarter was a bit bigger than our 1500 weight. And it droned along. Well, not even thinking it could be North Koreans or Chinese. We just all jumped up. And it turned out to be Canadians. The Canadians were somewhere anyway. They wondered where we'd come from. And they were all joking and laughing with branded wet. They gave us Canadian Club whiskey, which the first time I'd ever had a drink, and I felt really ill with it after. I'll get that down, you know. And they took us back to our forward company, you know, where we'd come from, which in those days used to be called TAC HQ. TAC, I suppose that's Tactical Headquarters, I suppose, I don't know. But TAC HQ, ASH and BSH, but TAC HQ is where we made for. Dropped